first half, second half, like chalk and cheese.
That can't be my best bet, but it's up there.
Yeah, it's no stupid red card, that's for sure.
We'll give you the balls so that we can spring on you and then claw your face off and eat your flesh.
I'm not fully keeping it together. Putting the high line with Rabbi in red. Talking the rabbits and turning heads. With questions from you and analysis. In your car, in your home. Thank you for tuning to Holding the High Line.
Hello, Rapids fans, and welcome to Holding the High Line with Rabbi in Red. My name is Matt Pollard. We are coming to you on the evening of Tuesday, March 5th, 2019, officially our first podcast in the month of March 2019. The New York Red Bulls have just been defeated by Santos Laguna at Red Bull Arena by a score of 2-0, and then we are potting as Houston Dynamo are taking on Tigres in what looks like to be a very raucous atmosphere at BBVA Compass Stadium. Rabbi Mark Goodman, my friend, I am done thawing out. All of my fingers and limbs are here. Do you have any home remedies for frostbite and gangrene?
A little bit of lemon and a lot of scotch.
Okay.
You take the lemon, you cut it into pieces, then you put it in your fridge and you save it for the next time you need to eat some fish, and then you drink the scotch. That's pretty much my remedy. Yeah, we're getting all that weather now here in Pittsburgh. It's like degrees right now and snowing again. So it's been lousy cold for the last like 48 hours. But my kids had the day off from school yesterday, so I took them sledding and we had a really good time. So there's a great hill in Denver that all of you know out in Colorado called Ruby Hill, best sledding hill in the world. Here in Pittsburgh, there's a pretty decent facsimile. So highly recommend it. Make sure that you ditch at least half a day of work this season and go sledding. Otherwise, you should just move to California because you're not taking advantage of winter, guys.
Excellent stuff, Mark. You know.
Also, someone's while you're at it, save them the trouble of taking their kids having to take their kids sledding. You can take some small children sledding. They'll have fun. Just, you know, hijack someone off the street. They'll thank you for it later.
Speaking, Mark, of people who didn't have anywhere to be on Monday and got to go play hooky and go sledding, Skelshen Gashi is no longer a member of the Colorado Rapids. He was waived by the club in the final hours on Friday before the roster compliance deadline, 5 p.m. Pacific time, if I'm not mistaken. So he is no longer a member of the Colorado Rapids. Basically, folks, what that means is the Rapids still have him on the books, but they've said that he is no longer a part of the team. That frees up a general roster spot, since Gashi was a DP and a member of the senior roster. That freed up a senior roster spot for the club. That obviously freed up a DP slot, should they choose, or that does not free up a DP slot, because his salary is technically still on the books for the club until he is claimed in some capacity. We'll get to that in a little bit. But the main thing for the Rapids is they freed up an international roster spot. Thus, with Sam Nicholson getting his green card, the club is now compliant as far as all of their roster news and regulations. Mark, you've got the Sam Stasko article up there with some of the nitty-gritty details. Why don't you read us the highlights and then provide some of your annotations?
I mean, you know, Sam Stasko did a pretty good job of detailing it. He got first to it, so he did a really if you really want to get into nerdy journalist stuff, Matt, he actually broke the story 6 minutes before the Rapids did, which begs the question, who was Sam talking to that he got all the neat details? And more importantly, why didn't you and me get all the neat details? But props to Sam Stachel, who did a great amount of reporting on this. Nobody else in the MLS world really understands the details of rosters as well as him. The other thing that's interesting, Matt, is that Major League Soccer didn't release their roster rules and regulations for 2019 until everything was done on the end of the day on Friday. But this is, again, hardcore nerding. So the basics are this. The Rapids waived Skelshen Gashi. Gashi was set to make last year $1.67 million. I'm reading right from the article. By waiving him, Colorado assumed responsibility for Gashi's entire salary. The league will no longer pay the first $530,000 of his wages as they do with DPs on an active roster. And then he had, according to MLS waiver rules, he had 48 hours to be claimed by another team. Obviously, as we all know, he was not claimed by another team because nobody in their right mind would claim a player who was that expensive. Although the way the waiver worked was that technically any team could claim him, by offering whatever amount they wanted for him. And then they would pay that amount of his salary and the Rapids would be on the hook for the rest. So I think Colorado was maybe hoping someone was willing to offer him, you know, $200,000 and save them a couple bucks. Apparently nobody did, which is a kind of a fascinating intellectual question of asking the question, if you're a Major League Soccer team, how much of a conversation did you have with your other staff about whether this guy was worth having? Think about it this way. There are 24 teams in Major League Soccer, and every single one of them said to themselves, this guy's not worth a plug nickel, and he wouldn't make our roster, right? That's an absolute flamethrower of a statement. It's one thing to wave a player and say he didn't work with us. It's another thing to say he wouldn't work with anybody. I mean, the parallel in the Pittsburgh sports world is Antonio Brown, who's this running back who like refused to play in at the end of the season for the Steelers. And like he got released by the team, which is a big problem, but now he's out there and he's a good running back and somebody else is going to pick him up. Like imagine being that kind of player, but nobody wants you. And I'm not talking some, you know, controversial player like Colin Kaepernick. I'm talking like a good solid player or a guy who used to be a good solid player who doesn't engender any controversy. Anyways, point being, long story short, basically Gashi's gone. The Rapids have to pay the full amount. They have no money for their DP slot, because that money is gone. They can't reallocate it. It doesn't come free until the 2020 season. And all, as you put it, all the Rapids gain from this is they get the international slot that they lacked before this moment. The Rapids had 8 international players on Friday afternoon. And Friday afternoon, they announced they only had 6 international slots. Friday afternoon, they announced, 2 moves that would clarify and fix that problem. Situation one was they got Sam Nicholson, who is a Scottish player, a green card, which allows him to be a non-international player for MLS purposes. And the second move they made was by waiving Gashi. So possibly the most expensive decision to save an international slot in Major League Soccer history. And then the question that I think for me obviously opens up, which we'll get to at Ask HDHL, is, was there another way of doing this? Was there a way to buy an international slot, or was Gashi that hopeless and out of favor with the club that they basically said like, yeah, we'd rather pay you to not play than pay you and be forced to play you.
Yeah, no, I agree with you, Mark. A couple of things that I'll add there. First of all, just in case, you know, before we get a whole bunch of angry tweets at us, Mark, Brown is a wide receiver. You could have been confusing him with Le'Veon Bell, possibly, who is a running back.
No, I just don't like throw ball. I just don't care at all.
Okay, so there's two separate Steelers players who had controversies this season, one of whom was Le'Veon Bell, who was basically sitting out his contract and wanting to get paid and then basically didn't because he sat out the entire season, and he was their running back, and then Antonio Brown, who had a whole bunch of chemistry issues with a whole bunch of other players and then was basically demanding to get traded. And I don't follow throw ball, at least not on the Steelers side of things, enough to know what their future is right now, but, you know, they're out there in the ether. So a couple things here. First of all, folks, because MLS is single entity, technically MLS owns his contract and the Rapids just approved it. So MLS still has the rights to Skelton Gashi, so he could potentially go out on loan. So Mark, if the Pittsburgh Riverhounds are interested in Skelton Gashi, that's potentially something that they could negotiate with MLS upon. And they could also look to a move elsewhere. Obviously, as we're talking now, you know, first full week of March, pretty much every single window as far as Europe is concerned is closed. I presume if Gashi were to go anywhere, it would probably be back to Europe, both for visa reasons and then also his experiences. So obviously, you know, if he wants to make a move to Switzerland or Albania or anywhere in the middle of the European continent, that's pretty much going to have to wait until the summer. So something is going to happen in terms of somebody being willing to take on Gashi and then take on some level of his salary in order for the Rapids to not be responsible for the rest of his 2019 salary. You know, if he goes on loan for $1 for the Pittsburgh Riverhounds, then, you know, the Rapids owe $1.64999 million to Skelton Gashi. Obviously, somebody could pick him up for the entire salary. MLS could also negotiate a transfer, probably a free transfer, in that would effectively wipe at, once that happens for the remainder of the calendar year, that would wipe his salary off. And then obviously, depending on when it happens, it could also wipe out the DP slot if it's early enough in the year that it doesn't tip Gashi's salary paid by the Rapids for the entire calendar year above the DP max budget player salary cap. That's going to be like a third of the way through the year, I think, since it's just over $500,000. And then he was getting roughly $1.6 million. And then if a transfer fee somehow is paid for Skelton Gashi, the Rapids don't get to keep any of that. That's basically all of that money just goes back into the league ether to be distributed as targeted allocation money when they re-up for that, or general allocation money, or, you know, probably back into Don Garber's checkbook as well. So those are kind of all the things that are going on there. None of that really affects the Rapids on this front, or at least it's not something they have a whole lot of control over right now because they chose to waive him. I think this is more just a statement that I think Anthony Hudson and the coaching staff, Mark, probably knew that he was a complete lame duck for this season. They weren't bringing him back. He didn't really fit into the system that they had, based on, you know, the depth chart that we had. You know, I'm not even sure that he's the first attacker on the bench or even was going to be a regular in the 18 when he was healthy. And you could argue with the direction that the Rapids were going on set pieces as well, that having Gashi on the field for a direct set piece wasn't necessarily as valuable, given all the detriments that he might have had, you know, when you were actually in the middle of play. So, you know, and maybe there's something in there with the Rapids training staff and the, you know, medical staff that's in there that saw him last year when he came back in and was in better shape. You know, going back to the Porrick Smith quote going into, I think, 2017, where Skelton Gashi, you know, came into preseason camp, quote, quite a bit out of shape, end quote. And maybe they just came in and thought, you know, yeah, we've had a year to work with him. We've had a year to try and make things work. It wasn't great in 2018. We don't think he's going to be there in 2019. And then the club just saw him, you know, his salary was a sunk cost because it was a guaranteed contract. So, you know, those are all the sort of things that I'm pittering about in my head. You know, I guess the thought was, well, we're going to have to pay him anyways. Why go give another competitor in MLS, you know, $100,000 in GAM, $150,000 in TAM, whatever it ended up being, in order to acquire an international roster spot, if we think that we have enough depth such that Gashi doesn't need to play a random midweek game or start in an Open Cup game or come off the bench. You know, if they didn't see that may, you know, I guess the bigger indictment for me, Mark, isn't that Gashi wasn't picked up off waivers, is the Rapids saw all the minutes and all of the collective, contributions above replacement for Gashi for the entire season was less than the value of an international roster spot. So effectively, they're saying that Gashi wasn't worth $100,000 in GAM and the minimum that you have to give up in order to make a transfer as far as like cash is concerned in MLS is $50,000. So, that's all of these things are damning as far as Skelton Gashi's, his status with the club as of Friday afternoon, and I think certainly indicative of his future or probably lack thereof. Do you see anything happening with him at this point, Mark? Or, you know, are we looking at him going to like the second or third division in Switzerland and just playing out if he wants to keep playing?
Yeah, I mean, I've been looking that up while you've been talking to try and figure out, like, where could he play if he wanted to? So the only two countries I saw that have an open window that seems – well, there's a couple. Okay. So the countries that have an open transfer window right now that Gashi could still get into are Brazil, Japan – Sweden, Major League Soccer, the Norwegian League, and Indonesia. So it's a very short list of places that he could end up in. I don't understand, and I couldn't figure this out, what the rules are in countries where the primary league has a transfer window and the secondary league does not, or whether the secondary league does or does not. I'm not sure. I feel like usually a second or a third tier league has like either no transfer rules or the rules change almost arbitrarily from country to country. The question then becomes, like, does a player who has a ton of money of guaranteed cash, do they even care anymore? You know, like, do they bother? You know, there's a reason why Pablo Mastroeni does not have a job in soccer right now. And it's not because nobody wants him. It's because it would cost Pablo Mastroeni more money to take another job. Because usually the way it works is if you take another job, the previous contract gets canceled. In soccer, with players, it's a guaranteed contract. I don't think for coaches it's necessarily a guaranteed contract. So my understanding was that Mastroeni wasn't going to take a job because if he took a soccer coaching job, the Rapids would stop paying him, which they are, by the way, still currently paying him. His contract runs through the end of this year. For Gashi, that doesn't apply. But the question becomes, does the dude even want to bother playing soccer at a high level? It's a good question. You know, if I were him, I would want to play. I would imagine somewhere in Japan or Sweden they would want him, and they don't have to pay him much to play. But that's, you know, who knows? You know, we'll either see him pop up or he'll join his buddy Stefan Aigner at KFC Unterhaching in a couple weeks.
Okay, I mean, I guess I can't remember how close we are to the French Open starting, but I think as soon as that ends, you know, we'll probably see an Instagram post of him and Roger Federer hanging out on Fed's yacht. I think that does it as far as our banter topic is concerned. Mark, shall we get to the madness that was Snow Classico 3 over the weekend?
Roll on, brother, roll on.
Rapids fans, this past Saturday at Dick's Sporting Goods Park, the Colorado Rapids hosted possibly one of the most memorable games in club history, and one that I think transcended the greater news media. If you saw from Business Insider, from the Huffington Post, a whole bunch of other major outlets that don't normally cover soccer or aren't covering MLS with any regularity or significance, certainly wanted to share all of the photos that were occurring this past Saturday. The Rapids played to a 3-3 draw with the Portland Timbers in what we are calling hashtag Snow Classico 3. Snow Classico 2 being the 2016 game between the Rapids and the New York Red Bulls. That was a 2-1 win for the Rapids, a 3-1, I believe. Jermaine Jones made his debut in burgundy and blue and scored a goal that night. And of course, the original Snow Classico being the 2013 hexagonal game for the United States men's national team against Costa Rica. That was a 1-0 win for the Yanks. I believe Clint Dempsey in the 19th minute, if I'm not mistaken. This was Tim Howard's first Snow Classico. Tim Howard had not signed with the Rapids as of Snow Classico 2, and Brad Guzan started in Snow Classico 1 for the United States men's national team. We knew that it was going to be cold, Mark. There was a little bit of doubt in terms of how much precipitation there was going to be and what the final temperature was going to be. Ultimately, as of if you're going by kickoff temperature, this was the coldest MLS game regular season or playoffs, officially breaking the 2013 MLS Cup that Sporting Kansas City hosted at Children's Mercy Park with a temperature of 18 degrees Fahrenheit without wind chill at kickoff opening up in the 16th minute. Kai Kamara has a very good tap-in goal from Kellen Acosta and some great work from Dylan Serna as well. Diego Valeri converted on a PK in the 29th minute after Axel Schuberg was sent off in the 27th minute that saw a VAR review confirm. We'll get to that in a bit, Mark. A handball on Axel Schuberg and then a goal by Portland that was ultimately waved off for being offside. A minute into stoppage time in the first half, Sebastian Blanco, of all people, scores on a redirected header off of a Diego Valeri corner. Benny Fellhaber scores just 1 minute into the first half on a great dribble up the middle of the Portland Timbers defense, gets a bounce, and then is able to sneak one in past Jeff Antonella, who did not have his footing right for much of the game. Declan Wynn commits an own goal in the 66th minute, and then Andre Shinyasiki, subbing in for the team in the final couple of minutes of the game, scores in the 90th minute plus four on a great tap-in after the Rapids are throwing numbers forward. Deflection comes to Dylan Serna. He sends it on goal. Jeff Atenelle is able to tap it away, but right to Shinyashiki sitting on the back post, wearing short sleeves no less, taps it into the back of the goal and then runs full knee sliding into the snow flurry mosh pit that was the Rapids sideline. Mark, what was your good thing from the Rapids? I will call it a 3-3 win against the Portland Timbers on Saturday.
Oh, man. I mean, I feel bad about taking the good thing from you, Matt, because you always throw to me for the first good thing. And then I always finish the good thing and you go, I agree, Mark. But that's just your tick. That's your thing. Like you love the I agree. I mean, I am a fanboy for the homegrowns always. And I am a fanboy for the locals, which is ridiculous now that I'm not a Coloradan. Which is also more ridiculous than that I'm not a native Coloradan. I'm a transplant, just like almost everybody, except for the people with the native bumper stickers. So, of course, my good things were there was this shake and bake move that was a take on by Cole Bassett in the, I think, about 18th minute of the game that was just magnificent to see the kid just, you know, burning down the wing and torching a Portland defender was a good thing. By the same logic, the same idea, Shinyashiki's 93rd minute wonderful back post tap-in was just fantastic to see. I mean, the dude had been on the pitch for all of, I think, 17 minutes in the game when he put that one away. And the fact that they just left him absolutely wide open alone at the back post – I mean, granted, you know, a goalkeeper has to block the ball and tap the ball in an exactly perfectly terrible direction in order to give the ball up for a rebound in that position. But Shinyashiki was all alone in the right place at the right time for a hugely consequential goal. I guess there's two more good things. I know it's like, do I only get one good thing? Can I do four? Do you remember, Matt, the last time we did good thing, how many times either of us came up with multiple good things? Like, that's how good this game was. The other two good things I would say was the Rapids used the 4-4-2 diamond to a beautiful sense of effect. They used the diamond for one-touch passing and quick movement in the way that I had kind of always envisioned it. There were multiple times where, especially before the snow really started to accumulate, the ball movement was really sharp and precise and thoughtful and problematic for Portland. And it was like, holy crap, they're making this look good. They're making this work. This is an attack. We attack. When did we attack before? I haven't seen an attack since 2014. I've been rooting for this team forever, you know? And, you know, all of the long balls in 2016 do not count as an attack. And the final thing, I guess, of the good things that I was thinking was that, you know, Kai Kamara just was really being used exactly the way you imagine him to be used. You know, big guy, making headers, causing problems, being physical, breaking through the line, making runs. I mean, it was just, there were just a lot of there was a lot of where we were sold a bill of goods in the off season. Like, we're just going to bring in these veterans. We're going to bring in the 4-4-2 diamond. We're going to be playing attacking football. Trust me, it's all going to be great. And because we're Rapids fans, we all looked up and we were like, nah, we've fallen for this many, many times. We've been bamboozled. We've been hoodwinked many a time. We are not going to be fooled by the pretty PR language and our ticket reps selling us on a partial season ticket pass because, you know, we've got a couple shiny new objects. No, like the shiny new objects were shiny and they were good. And so there was a lot of good things. All right, Matt, have I taken all the good things or do you have good things? Or are you just going to say, I agree?
No, we have so many good things to talk about, Mark. And I have a few that you didn't mention. You didn't mention it specifically, but, you know, you had three goals from the Colorado Rapids on Saturday and you had all three from debutants. Kai Kamara, first start for the Colorado Rapids. Benny Fellhaber, first start for the Colorado Rapids. And Andre Shinyashiki scoring 17 minutes in to his MLS debut, you know, a little bit behind Nicky Jackson, who scored, you know, a minute and 23 seconds in stepping onto the field in MLS for the first time. So, Andre, you've got some catching up to do on your elder statesman there. But that was fantastic. And really, with the exception of Diego Rubio, who I put a big asterisk next to because he was subbed out in the 30th minute. This was just after the red card, and Danny Wilson had to come on because other than that, the Rapids would have been playing with three at the back. Every single Rapids debutant that we had on Saturday, I thought, had a fantastic performance. I thought Keegan Rosenberry did a lot of good things. You know, it wasn't his first start with the Rapids, but the first time we've seen him at left back. I really liked what I saw from Dylan Sunner for the first time in person at left back. I liked what we saw from Benny Fellhaber on both sides of the ball. You can make an argument that even though he didn't get a goal or an assist, that Nicholas Mesquita was the best of the new players. And then obviously Kai Kamara, Andre Shinyashiki getting the goals as well. I posted a tweet, a Twitter poll from Rapids 96 podcast on Twitter, Mark, initially asking for the man of the match. And initially I just thought, okay, let's go with the three goal scorers. And then because it was Snow Classico, I was going with Mother Nature as well. And immediately I got not some backlash, but some people saying like, Matt, you'd snubbed Mesquita, who was arguably the best player on the field. So, okay, you know, you figure Kai Kamara had a tap-in goal. You know, in terms of who gets the reward pie of who gets the biggest slice of that, a lot of that goes to Kellen Acosta. A good chunk of that goes to Dylan Cerna. You know, Kai Kamara just had to make the run, be open, and then not completely flub on a completely wide open goal. So, you know, I said that, but then people were chiming in for Cerna, and you can make an argument with the visibility being poor and being not able to handle his footing at all, that, you know, Tim Howard was having to fight off shots at him to where he was having to correct mid-air, mid-shot in order to make it. You can go up and down the lineup. Other than Declan Wynn, who gave up an own goal, where I'm not sure that's entirely his fault, again, given the conditions, you could make it, you know, there's, you know, I could say that there's a four-way tie for man of the match for the Colorado Rapids, and I could say that nobody's finishing worse than third in terms of that hierarchy. You know, when was the last time, Mark, I could say from front to back, you had fabulous performances by entire units and individuals in moments and over 90 minutes? And, you know, all of that, given the conditions, given going down a man, given giving up two leads in the game, I thought, you know, that has to be spectacular. Anthony Hudson has to feel so much better about his team in terms of individual performances and guys who are willing to fight and figure it out, knowing that he has options now. The other thing that I'll say, we talked a lot about last season, the first half substitutions made by Anthony Hudson. And even though some of those in the moment seemed like good moves or ones that ended up working out for the team in terms of whether it was personnel or tactics or not liking a particular matchup, ultimately, you know, if you have to sub out Kip Colby 23 minutes into a game, that on some level has to be an indictment of either the player personnel selection or the initial game plan, that your game plan didn't even survive 23 minutes, of contact with the enemy. I don't think any soccer plan other than low block route one soccer is going to be able to survive 4 inches of snow and 18 degree temperatures. But as soon as you go a man down in, you know, in the first part of the first half. I think everything that you had immediately has to get thrown out the window. I thought Danny Wilson came in and was much better than I was probably expecting him to be, given the weather conditions. And then we'll get to this in a little bit, Mark, where we have some audio from the players. But Hudson, you know, it quickly devolved into a 4-4-1. And then in the 40th minute, Jack Price came on for Cole Bassett, and it turned into a 4-2-2-1 with two holding midfielders and then two eights in front of them. So Kellen Acosta, Nicholas Mosqueda in sort of the front midfield, and in their back midfield, Benny Fellhaber and Jack Price, with Jack Price, I would say, being the true holding midfielder, and then Benny Fellhaber getting up into the attack a few times when the opportunity presented itself. But with that, given the conditions and the way that Portland was playing, that allowed the Rapids to defend with six field players, the four back line and the two in front, and then still have some semblance of an offense when they're able to turn the ball over that wasn't Kai Kamara holding up the ball and then trying to hold on to it for 10 seconds or force a foul just so that, you know, Keegan Rosenberry can actually take a breath. So, you know, I thought, you know, as much as we malign Hudson for his initial tactical game plans, for messing things up as far as substitution timing, personnel, adjustments, just, you know, throwing on forwards and hoping something works in the final 10 minutes, here was something where he immediately saw, this is what Portland is going to do. This is what's not working with Cole Bassett in this situation. I'm going to put this on and we'll see what's going to work. And I thought it was fabulous. I think it put it for what they had and the conditions, both environmental and playing down a man, I think it put everybody on the field in the best position to succeed. And ultimately they were able to get a share of the spoils.
Well said. Let's move on to the bad things.
Let's move on to the bad things, Mark. Where do you want to start?
Well, I mean, it's really interesting to be this positive about a game, to feel really good about the game, and then to also be, I mean, I can't remember a time in my entire soccer watching career where I could say, oh yeah, my team had an own goal, my team had a red card, and my team conceded a PK, and I still think that they had a great game. Like, that's very strange, right? So that's clearly the bad thing, right? Like, the team was, you know, we could relitigate Axel Schoberg's red card and PK call for hours. It was definitely a questionable call, but it could have gone either way. That, like, when you get your hands in front of a ball, you know that there's potential that something bad is going to happen, and Axel should have known that, right?
Yes.
So it's very interesting. It's a very interesting question of how the Rapids should have kind of gone about that and what they should have done differently. Is there anything that they could do differently on the red card, on the own goal? Yeah, not score an own goal. Like, I think someone on Twitter got into an argument with me about whether Declan Wynn should be criticized because he had a good game other than that. But, like, you know, if a defender, and this is the tricky thing we've talked about before with defenders, if a defender makes 15 tackles and he completely biffs on a take-on the 16th time and completely gets skinned, and that player waltzes in on goal and beats the goalkeeper, and they win 1-0, then he screwed up, and the loss is on him. Like, that's the hard, you know, that's the challenge of being a center back or a fullback, right? If Kai Kamara takes 10 shots on goal and he misses 9 of them, like blows them over the goal, but he scores the 10th in the top corner, he's the hero. If a defender has 9 great tackles and biffs the 10th, he's a goat. That's the unfairness of being a defender versus being a forward. But that's the reality of the game, man. You cannot, as a defender, you need to be able to react and clear a ball in such a way that you don't put it in your own net. And if you put it in your own net, you're responsible. And there's no way around it, right? Like, that's at the professional level, when you're making a 6-figure or a 7-figure salary to play soccer, like, that's the job. And you signed up for it and you got to do it. So that's my two takeaways. You know, it's very hard for me, Matt, because I hate falling into traps to say, I'm just going to lean back on my old saw of picking on Declan Wynn, because I spent all of 2018 beating up Declan Wynn, just putting him in a potato sack and going to town on him, you know? And I don't want to be that guy. I don't want to be the guy who walks into the year and just says, all right, we're going to pick Declan Wynn as my scapegoat for the year. I want to believe that Declan Wynn grew in the offseason, that he's a good, solid soccer player. He also had a line breaking pass in the first that blew my mind. And if you look at his pass map, he had a ton of passes. They were good passes and they were very effective. Declan Wynn is a very good passer. I don't actually think I've ever said any differently about him. It's the defending that needs work and the decision making in crisis situations like ball clearances. So those are our bad things. Matt, did you have similar bad things? Did you have other bad things?
I mean, there are still things, I think, independent of being down a man, independent of the environmental conditions, that I think the Rapids could have done better on. I'll say what ultimately caused all three of the goals. I don't know how much you can fault Tim Howard for the actual PK. You know, yes, he makes the initial save, but at that point, the temperatures are so cold, you know, he's basically trying to catch a rock, and doing anything to redirect that is going to be extremely difficult. But, you know, okay, Mark, question. Who fired the shot that deflected off of Axel's hand to give him the red card?
I know this because I looked it up. It's Laris Mialba.
Okay, Laris Mialba. Yes, Laris Mialba, who, for those of you fans who did not see the – yes, a center back for the Portland Timbers. A center back for the Portland Timbers in the run of play was inside the penalty dot to deliver a shot that was trying to get a goal. That is the level of defensive breakdown you had going into the ultimately what led to the first goal. Obviously, David Guzman puts the end of that play into the net, but then the only thing in advantage that you have on a foul committed inside the box is an immediate valid goal. So then that caused the PK that ultimately caused the first goal, even if it wasn't the first goal itself. So, you know, the Rapids are still seem to be struggling or still working on the process of preventing a fire before the fire starts. On the second goal, again, in spite of the environmental conditions, the guy who gets the head to that ball to sneak in inside the far post on Tim Howard is 5'7" Sebastian Blanco. You know, yes, okay, Axel isn't in the game at that point, but you have Danny Wilson. Kai Kamara was going up to defend balls in the box as well. He's at least 6 feet tall from last I remember. You know, you've got Declan Wynn, who isn't that short. You know, I know Dylan Cerna is listed as 5'6". I think Keegan Rosenberry is 5'8". I'm about the same height as Benny Fellhaber. So, you know, the one guy in the field who's shorter than Sebastian Blanco are probably Jack Price and and Dylan Cerna, and none of the other eight guys were able to beat Sebastian Blanco to that ball. You know, that's fundamentally a marking issue, and just switching off mentally and assuming that nobody was going to get to it, you know, that's a serious demerit independent of everything else that was going on. And then still, even, you know, I hesitate to criticize Declan Wynn for the own goal on the third goal for the Timbers, just because, you know, planting in those conditions is just extremely difficult. For those of you who've never played soccer in the snow, you know, I was talking to Benny Fellhaber post game, and you said, you know, by the end of the game, you know, there are 4 inches of snow on the ground. You know, that's, you're trying to plant in sand, and so you're trying, you know, you're putting all of your weight on one foot and then trying to make a cut, and then that foot slips. So then trying to do that while tracking a ball and trying to clear it, you know, with the ball, albeit being an orange one where the lighting was terrible, you know, the snow was almost like a fog around Dick's Sporting Goods Park. You know, the ball's coming out of nowhere. You're not able to track it as well. That's extremely difficult. You know, you're having to plant your foot and make an adjustment both in your body and in your reaction. And you could see on a number of those instances, even Danny Wilson, who, you know, I probably was putting in a potato sack and beating up in 2018, Mark, you know, you could see that there were clearly clearances that if it was 70 degrees and sunny and the grass was dry, he would have cleared out fine, that he was struggling just to make it be a corner that didn't remotely, like, that had no chance of reflecting on goals. So I think you have to give tremendous respect to all of the defenders who were just handling crosses like that and trying to block things out. And the fact that one of them, as Declan Wynn's slipping before the cross goes in, he accidentally puts it into the back of the net. That's not his fault, but the Timbers were attacking for 5 or 7 minutes at that point, and the Rapids, I think, could have done a little bit more to break that play up, or, you know, done a little bit better work to try and get the ball and then relieve the pressure, or at least, you know, punt it all the way back to Jeff Atanella and force it to be at least, you know, commit to the hockey analogy, I would say, is commit to it being icing rather than putting it up over the boards and then getting a delay of game. In hockey, Mark, when you're in your own defensive zone and you put the puck over the glass, that's considered a delay of game and it's a penalty. Whereas if you just shoot it all the way down and then an opponent gets to it first, then it's just a face off in your zone. So effectively a corner, you know, as opposed to, you know, going down a man for 2 minutes. I thought the Rapids could have done a little bit better job on that. You know, again, I hesitate to criticize them just given all the things that were going against them in the game, and I hesitate to take a bigger picture out of this in terms of the narrative for how the season's going to go, given that there was a first half red card, given the quality of the opponent they were seeing, given that it was the first game of the season and they're probably not fully fit, let alone the fact that they played in Snow Classico 3. With that, Mark, let's go on to, I do want to give a shout out to Eric Edwards on Twitter, who I had a very productive conversation with regarding the officiating. Eric has refereed in the semi-pro and then various levels within college and rec leagues as well, Mark. And we had a very healthy conversation to where I feel more informed about the red card. We can get to that when we get to Ask HTHL. So, Mark, what's your big thing from this game?
I think the big thing is believe the hype. It doesn't mean that you have to fall hook, line, and sinker for the possibility that the Colorado Rapids are the real deal. But at least believe the hype in the sense that this is a very different team, right? Like, I think some fans have a mental picture of the Rapids as a bad defensive team or just a bad team. And I don't think that is accurate anymore. You can either say this is going to be an exciting but sloppy team, or that it's going to be an attacking team with faults. But I don't think saying it's going to be bad or boring or defensive or losing is going to be accurate. You know, I think this team has the potential to be an offensive version of 2016, which is the 2016 Rapids were very lucky. The math for their goal differential didn't necessarily indicate that they were going to be the best team in the Western Conference that year, but they were. The math for this Colorado Rapids team may not put them as the best team in the league or the best team in the conference or the best offensive team in the conference. But if you get the breaks the right time and you score your goals at the right places, you can really have a great season. So, you know, one of the weird things about soccer is that you can be plus or minus 10 goals on goal differential, and that could mean the difference between second in the league and 12th in the league. And so when I say believe the hype, I mean, like, this team really will be in play. They're not going to be, I don't think some of the early punditry that said this was a bottom of the conference team, I don't think that's going to serve up to be accurate. And I think 3 months from now, 4 months from now, when we look at Portland, we'll see that this was a very good team that the Rapids went nose to nose with and came out with a 3-3 draw. Matt, what's your big thing?
Being the talk of the town, how many game recaps did we have last week, Mark, where we were going in and saying, you know, this was a boring game, this was an unexciting game, you know, if you had to pick one game to not watch on Saturday in the entire MLS slate, how many times was it the game involving the Colorado Rapids? And I was having this conversation, you saw on Twitter with my friends either in the media or just, you know, fans of other teams who were looking at it. Everybody was watching this game. Everybody was looking at the photos. Everybody was going back and looking at the highlights. You know, I was talking, I have a friend who, two friends, who just got engaged. They were living in Kansas City. One of them's from Portland. One of them's from Kansas City. They were Kansas City season ticket holders together. Obviously, there's a wait list for the Portland Timbers, but they go to Portland Timber games with regularity. Both of them, independently, having not talked about it, texted me and said, "Wow, Matt, that must have been fun yesterday." The thing that I constantly think about from a brain exercise standpoint when we talk about the irrelevancy of the Rapids, of the fact that, it's a relatively small club in the MLS space. It doesn't have a whole lot of exciting players. It doesn't play exciting soccer. It doesn't make big moves. You know, any opportunity Atlanta has to make a headline, one of the New York teams, one of the LA teams, they're going to do that. But the thing that I always sort of look at and say is, I think about a Portland Timbers fan and an Atlanta United fan on match day before the game. Say the Timbers fan is going to get, is going to get a coffee at their local, Mon-Pa coffee shop. I think about stereotypically the Atlanta fan going to Chick-fil-A, and I think about both of these fans pulling up the MLS app or pulling up Twitter and scrolling through and saying, what's going on before my game and everything, and I think what would have to pop up that was Colorado Rapids related for them to look up from their chicken sandwich or their soy kaffa vegan latte, whatever, to think the Portland, to think the Colorado Rapids did what now? And I would say the Kellen Acosta trade last year was in that. I would say collectively all of the inner MLS moves that the Rapids made are something that someone was paying attention to. Everybody was looking at this game. If you were not watching this game, if you weren't looking at the highlights, you checked it out on Sunday. You know, for once in I can't remember how long, the Colorado Rapids were the talk of the town on Sunday morning in the MLS Twitter sphere, in the MLS ether, for a good thing because of the result they got, the type of soccer that they played, and the environmental conditions. And, I was joking with a couple of the other people in the media box and a couple fans after the game saying, the last 2 hours were miserable and I'm not really entirely sure why I was there and I can't feel my fingers, but man, is this going to be a fun story tomorrow and a fun thing to bring up when I'm having a beer with somebody. And, it was a terrible moment sort of a thing, but it's something you're absolutely going to laugh about. And, that's a memory that I'm going to bring up every single time. And anytime somebody's asking me about the big Rapids games that I've covered and everything, like Snow Classico 3 has to be up there. And, it was fantastic to have that experience, to have that memory, and to know that the greater MLS community saw it and appreciated it for what it is. It was kind of nice to be the talk of the town for once.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, and this is really the question that I would love, that I am going to die about for the next 34 games. So excuse us fans if I'm going to fanboy out on Matt for the next 6 months. But so what was your experience like covering this game? Portland has a pretty big media following because they're a really big team in their town. What was it like interacting with the Portland journalists? What was the press box like? What did Hudson say in the post game? What was he like on his first post game in the new year? And what was the hallway like down in the guts of the DSGP building? Like, any memorable moments or interesting interactions with folks that you had?
There were a couple things. Last Word has done a little bit better job in terms of organizing things as far as coverage is concerned. And not that this is the inside baseball part of the podcast, Mark, but essentially we've kind of gone in the direction where if we have the staffing such that someone doesn't need to be live tweeting the game and covering it in person, and then also doing the immediately after full-time recap to where they can focus on something more in the post-game or, get an editorial out or more of an analysis piece rather than a straight recap. We try to do that, and I'm so grateful that we had somebody on staff doing the recap because, unlike the big chill at Dick's Sporting Goods Park against Toronto last year, where I was able to still type and I was functional from that standpoint, every couple of minutes I had to brush off or, blow air on my laptop because it was getting snow on top of it. It was like the joke I said in my long form editorial for Last Word, waxing poetic about it. It was as if I had a waiter standing over me and a sea salt grinder that he was just constantly putting onto my laptop. So I would wipe it off and then, some of that snow would turn into moisture. And eventually I realized by the end of the first half that a thin layer of ice, almost like pebbled, curling ice had formed over my laptop to the point where I was trying to type. I had to like push down with my fingers and my thumb really hard, and I was actually getting like crunchy feelings on it. So I thought, okay, screw the laptop. I'm going to throw that in. I'm going to put that inside in the press box and just let that dry and warm up. And I'm just going to do everything from my phone, which as long as it's plugged in to an outlet does fine in temperatures, and I can keep it in my pocket where it's dry. So that was just from an ergonomical standpoint, trying to watch the game in person live from an outdoor press box. Not a fun experience. At halftime, I had a very good conversation with Jamie Goldberg, who I'd never met before, who covers the Timbers for the Oregonian, she does excellent work as far as covering the team. She's not as familiar being a native Portlandian with dealing with snow, so she was inside for the entire time and just watching everything on TV. And you kind of saw gradually everybody in the press who was outside was gradually moving in there. And eventually, it was just me and Brian from Voice of C38. Where I tweeted out, you know, and then there were two, just the two of us. I ended up being the last man standing for Snow Classico 2.
That's how you roll. That's how you roll, Matt.
Thanks. So that ended up being that, you know, halftime, getting the warm cookies in the press box was a welcomed sight for everyone. Moved down. I would say it was a pretty straightforward press conference as far as Huzzin was concerned, you know, very no nonsense, you know, very candid. Fortunately for him, you know, he didn't have to come out and apologize for another loss and, you know, poor performances. And, you know, I would say it was, there were more people there, and I think everybody had questions to ask. So it was just kind of it was very straightforward in the sense that everybody had a question that they wanted to get in. So, you know, I'm going to answer the questions and be very brief and very succinct as far as giving the quote, and we're just sort of going to move on. So it was very organized and orderly in that sense. Benny Fellhaber, when he knows recording devices aren't recording him, is extremely hilarious, more so than Benny Fellhaber when he knows the cameras are on him, just in terms of approaching things like, God, like, you know, he came into the media scrum, he hadn't met a bunch of us, so, you know, he introduced himself and everything, and somebody in the back, I don't remember who, said, you know, Benny, how you feeling? He's like, I'm all right, man. I don't really, like, I have to watch it again. I don't remember much of the game. It's all kind of like one big blur. So, you know, it was a very human reaction from him. You know, Andre Shinyashiki, I thought, was a little not camera shy, but at least in my interview with him, I remember you telling me a story, Mark, where you went to a U23 game or something, and then somebody freaked out because, like, oh man, there's a journalist like watching us, even though we're just Rapids Academy players. And Shinyashiki had kind of that, where it's like, you know, okay, like a journalist from an outlet that isn't DU Athletics wanted to interview me. And then so he was kind of like, okay, there's this huge camera, like, I just scored a goal to get us a draw and everything, you know, I'm kind of, you know, we were all nice to him, and obviously it was easy question, you know, it's like, how do you feel? And, you know, when I can only imagine what it feels like stepping onto your first game, making your professional debut, and then getting a goal to help the team get a point, to where then it was easy for him to talk about things. Who was the other person who we spoke
to? Guys like Kai Kamara and for Benny Fellhaber, they have gone into the hallway and done that media interview literally 500 times. You know, I mean, Benny's done it on the national team scale. And so that kind of level of like, oh yeah, I come and I say some things, or some guys throw a microphone in my face and I recite the same thing that I always say, which is like, I'm glad I can help the team and blah, blah, blah. And for Shinyashiki, it was like, I don't know where I am. I've never seen this before. I have no idea what's going on. I could say the same stuff that I used to say in college, but it's a new place. It's a new feeling. And also, I'm exhausted and I'm freezing. Like, it's a lot of things at once. And so, you know, he's a rookie in a lot of senses. Like, he's a rookie in the hallway. That being said, like, I'm sure he was exceedingly professional and well prepared, but like, yeah, he's gonna have to kind of like get the patter down, like get comfortable, you know, and it takes everybody a little bit of time to get comfortable. You know, the cool thing, Matt, is you're comfortable. You've been doing this for a while.
Yeah. The only other big thing that I'll say, Mark, and I'll couple this a little bit with a trend that I've noticed. Hudson gave a quote that I ended up tweeting out from my personal account. I asked him about what explanation he got from the fourth official regarding the red card to Axel and if things changed between the call being made and then ultimately after, you know, the call was stood or confirmed, or I don't know if Pro prefers to use any language like that after the VAR review. So what happened, folks, was obviously the ball hit Axel's hand and was deflected up in the air. There were two Portland Timbers players who were offsides, one of whom was David Guzman, who ultimately headed the rebound off of Big Axe's hand into the net. He was whistled for offsides. MLS has made it pretty clear, and Pro has made it pretty clear in their officiating, that offsides doesn't take effect until the player who is offsides has some impact on the game. You know, if Sam Nicholson is all the way on the other touchline, picking his nose or tying his shoe or stretching or something, and then Kellen Acosta hits an absolute golazo from 40 yards out, but Sam Nicholson was 1 yard offsides, he didn't have any impact on the actual play. So even though at the time of the shot by Lars Mabiallo that ultimately deflected off Axel's hand, there were two Timbers players offsides, one of whom played the ball, they don't actually count as offsides until they played the ball and then put it into the net. So that is why when the goal went in, the official put his hand up. The head official, Drew Fisher, had waived advantage off of the deflection and then gave the PK. Per the laws of the game, the only thing that counts as playing advantage when a foul is committed in the box is an immediate and valid goal. So if the ball deflects off of Axel's hand and then there's a player who's onside who has an open goal to tap it in, advantage goal stands. If the deflection goes off of Axel's hand and finds its way of its own accord in the back of the net, advantage goal stands. Because that didn't happen, then the official gave the PK and then the red card to Axel Schuberg. In other cases where it wasn't that case, where the goal would have counted already, then it would have only just been a yellow card to Axel. But the big sticking point here for me right now, Mark, especially after the review, so the explanation that Anthony Hudson was given after the review was the ball went off of Axel's hand. It gave an advantage to the Rapids in terms of the deflection, but there was nothing that he could have done about that. Just before Axel was coming off, I don't know if he was coming off of the ground or about to hit it, but he slipped trying to defend against Lars Mabiallo. There was already an inch of snow on the ground. Axel's a big guy who's very top-heavy, who has a high center of gravity. He fell, and then, of course, your natural reaction when you're falling down, Mark, from 6 feet, 7 in the air, is to brace yourself with your hands. And in doing so, hand hits ground, hand comes up, and then obviously Lars Mabiala's shot goes directly off of the hand. So the explanation was, yes, it hit his hand, but there was nothing he could have done about it. I heard that and immediately thought, how is that not a textbook definition of ball to hand?
Ball to hand, yes, right, exactly.
I have noticed, Mark, in the last couple of years, especially last year with VAR being input, that MLS has a very, at least relative to me, and I would say relative to other soccer leagues that I watch with regularity, I would say certainly the EPL, Champions League, and Liga MX, even those that do have VAR as well, have a very narrow definition of what ball to hand counts as, and then what is also counts as the hand or the arm being in a natural position. You saw on Saturday morning,
which isn't, by the way, in the rules of the game anywhere. It doesn't say in rule law 12 of FIFA is the law that deals with penalties and handballs, but there's nothing in the language that says the player should have his hands in a natural position. That's one of those kind of like commentaries that got added on, which is totally logical and completely legitimate, but we're already into a gray area of like ball to hand, hand to ball, natural position, unnatural position. And I'm with you. Like, I'm with Coach that, like, it seemed to me that Axel fell, he braced his hands underneath him during the fall, and the ball hit his hand while he was on the ground. That being said, like, you could make the argument that he shouldn't have fallen, that he was falling to try and dive at the ball, but it really is.
I am going to fall so that I have to brace myself in my hand, and then my hand will deflect the ball, and in knowing that the referee will see that I fell, will think that it was ball to hand, and therefore think that it was non-intentional, and therefore we will be able to prevent the goal, and then I will also not get a PK called against me. Aha, Drew Fisher!
Right. Axel Schoberg would have to be doing some quantum physics level planning in order to have intentionally stopped that. On the other hand, there is a reverse angle that somebody from of course, the Portland fan base showed me where right before the ball is kicked, it looks like Axel is diving at the ball. That being said, like, your intent in the 0.3 seconds before the ball is struck and what happens when the ball is struck and hits your hand doesn't necessarily correspond. I don't know. It's kind of a mess. Like, on some level, I can kind of understand the decision. On another level, I think it was a bad call. So I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, the big question for me, and I know that we're off on a tangent, but it's a good tangent. The big question for me has to do – not even a question. The big problem for me is the Rapids had a very thin bench of center backs to start this game. Court Ford was hurt. Kofi Opara was hurt. I remember seeing that Tommy Smith was hurt.
Hearing that Tommy Smith is expected to be available selection hopefully for Saturday.
And that Wilson was questionable. So that means that, like, you know, there was a very thin bench of center backs going into this game. It was good that they wound up having three, but for next game, now it's Wilson, Wynn, and apparently Smith, hopefully as long as he's healthy this week.
Yeah.
But anyways.
So, you know, I agree with you, Mark, that I think MLS is a very narrow definition of it. You know, if I tomorrow am named Emperor of FIFA and I get to change that, you know, I find there is some gray area in ball to hand. I really don't like it when refs or pundits or fans are trying to gauge intent. I just think it's way too hard, you know, in a split section reaction to imply that, you know, a player was trying to break the rules. You know, if you're trying to gauge, you know, was his intent to play the ball with his hands? Was his intent to hurt the opponent? Was he just trying to play the ball? Was he just trying to get positioning? You know, that's very difficult. You know, if I could just completely blow up the handball rule, I would simply do a was advantage gained. Forget where his hand was replaced. So no natural position. Forget any sort of reaction, so forget ball to hand, forget any intent to play the ball with the hand, was advantage gained. And in that, you know, obviously Axel's hand blocked a shot for Lars Mabiala that was presumably going on goal. Tim Howard was going the opposite direction, so I assume if Axel's hand wasn't there, it probably would have gone in the back of the net. And then ultimately the advantage played led to an offsides goal. So in that sense, I would have still called the PK, but I would simply do a was advantage gained. If it hits off of his hand and then it falls to a Timbers player who's onside, then it's not handball. You know, if that allows a teammate next to him to clear the ball off the line, then that's advantage gained. I realize that's maybe an oversimplification that some fans might not like. You know, it leaves out a lot of judgment for the referee, because I think gauging advantage is very easy to do when it comes to handball. But I think it would also level out in the wash. You know, you're going to get these calls and these bounces go against you, but I think it would make things a lot simpler for the officials and for the players, just to know that it doesn't matter, just as long as, you know, you don't get an advantage from it. You know, and if the ball ends up, you know, if Dylan Cerna is guarding somebody on the edge of the box and the ball accidentally hits his hand and then just drops right there on the touchline, if he just steps back and doesn't play the ball and lets the opponent have it, then that's not advantage, and he knows that and he can handle that. And I think that's a lot better than for Dylan Cerna in a split second to realize that he has to tuck his hands behind his back in order for his hands to not be, you know, in order for his hands to be in a natural position. You know, I don't know if you saw the Philly-Toronto game, but there was a PK called in that one on a Philadelphia Union player in which the ball appeared to go off the, I would call it like right where the ball and socket joint in the shoulder connects, Mark. So some of these calls that pros making with the advantage of VAR is effectively telling defenders that the only natural position for you to have your hands be in is for basically us to lightsaber you off at the shoulder blade, which, but in any case, we've talked way too much about this game. There were some really good comments regarding the Hudson tactical switch and the relationship between Benny Fellhaber and Jack Price in the midfield that I really, really liked, folks, as opposed to me trying to quote them on the podcast and have me and Mark talk about them. Benny and Jack are two very articulate, very intelligent soccer players, so I'm going to let the words speak for themselves. So we're going to start with audio from Benny, where I asked that question about the tactical switch to the 4-2-2-1 with the two sixes. Benny and Jack, and then Jack Price subbing on. Then we'll get to Jack Price, and then we've got a new segment for you that I'll leave to be a surprise when we get there. And then Mark, you and I will be back after all three of those things to properly preview the Rapids game against the Seattle Sounders on Saturday. Listeners, we'll be right back.
Coach said after the red card he wanted to switch things to 2 sixes and 2 eights in the middle, and then Jack Price comes in. It seems like that calmed things down. Your thoughts on that and the relationship with Jack?
I think that was a great substitution. I think I needed someone next to me at that point. Price, he's a guy that has experience. He's a guy that knows how to play, you know, whether you're up a man, down a man, or with 11s on 11-11. And so for him to come into that game and, like you said, settle things down, kind of gave me a guy to have support side by side. I think it was a great substitution. He did really well. Like I said, all the guys that came in did a fantastic job in a game that is extremely difficult to do well off the bench. And so, I think it's great. I think we can even use that sometimes when it's 11-11 because Pricey gives us that balance where, me and him really are good at playing with the backs and coming out of the back and building out. And he gives me a little bit of freedom to go forward as well. And, you know, I probably owe my goal to him because I probably wouldn't dribble that ball that deep into their box when, I'm supposed to be the deepest guy in the midfield. So, he gives me a lot of balance and I think it was a great move from the gaffer to bring him in.
Gaffer was kind of explaining his thought process with everything after the red card. And obviously, you go down a man and a defender, you have to bring on Danny Wilson as a center back. But then he was kind of thinking to sort of stabilize the middle channel, 2 sixes and 2 eights instead of the diamond.
Yeah.
And we were talking with Benny. He thought you really helped out from a sub standpoint.
Yeah.
What was the message from the gaffer and how did things sort of settle down once you came in?
It was more me coming in to maybe shore it up in the middle. So me, obviously, me and Benny went as a six. And I think it allowed Kellen and Nico to be a bit more advanced and a bit more freedom, so they could go out and do what they wanted. You know, Nico in the second half, he was ripping him apart in the box, so it just gave him let him free and just go and do what he wants to do, which is good at attacking players. And you know, if we had to cover, me and Benny were going to cover, you know, it's our job as a six as well. And also we had more control of the ball, I thought. Obviously going down to 10 men, we needed, you know, that reassurance in the midfield.
Yeah.
Welcome back, listeners, to Holding the High Line with Rabbi in Red. My name is Matt Pollard. This is the debut of a new segment Mark and I are calling Know Thy Enemy, where we bring in someone familiar with the Rapids opponent for the week and get their take on the current state of the Rapids opponent and maybe what they see in that matchup. For the inaugural episode of this segment, I brought in Ari Lilienwall of MLSsoccer.com, who covers the Seattle Sounders. Ari, hello, sir.
How you doing, Matt?
That's good. First of all, not a whole lot of form to talk about with the Sounders, just the one game played, but I would say a very comprehensive victory over FC Cincinnati in their first appearance in MLS. Your thoughts on the overall performance on Saturday night, a 4-1 win over FCC?
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to look at it with a bit of a grain of salt, given that you're talking about a Cincinnati team that was literally playing its first ever MLS game. They clearly haven't really just had the time to gel yet or form an identity, maybe as much as some expansion teams in the past. So with that said, I think when you're a team like the Sounders in that situation, you have to do what you're supposed to do and take care of business and ideally do it in convincing fashion. And that's exactly what they did. And I think you can also glean a little bit just from how they played in terms of what they want the attack to look like. I mean, with Jordan Morris back, everyone saw what he brings to the table when he's healthy and, you know, firing. But I think, you know, if you're a Sounders fan looking at that game, you can be encouraged by how the whole front four played. Victor Rodriguez was all over the place in that game too. Nicolas Ladero was doing all the things that he usually does. Raul Ruiz Diaz gets his goal. So, I think you need to take the opponent into account a little bit. They looked overmatched, and the Sounders were really just having a field day on the flanks. But like I said, you need to take care of business in those games, and they did that. So I think it's kind of a good start to the season for them in terms of their, you know, the big thing with the Sounders this year is trying to get rid of the mantra of being a team that starts slow and then has to get hot late and salvage the playoff spot. So if you want to kind of nip that narrative in the bud right away, doing what they did against Cincy is at least a good place to start.
Absolutely. Perfect segment going into Jordan Morris. Obviously his first game in, I don't know, was it 530 some days, missed the entirety of the 2018 season. Rapids fans probably have a lot of bad memories about Jordan Morris. If I'm not mistaken, I think his first professional goal was at Dick's Sporting Goods Park in 2016. And obviously he was a major part of that Sounders team that undid Pablo Mascherini and hashtag keep fighting in their bid to ultimately win MLS Cup 2016. We haven't really, at least here in Colorado, Colorado, maybe they haven't really been focusing too much on, you know, his overall rehab and everything coming back and everything that it took for him just to be able to start last Saturday night. You know, from someone who obviously covers this team regularly, walk me through what Jordan Morris has been doing behind the shadows and just the monumental return to the lineup that was his performance and obviously getting the goal on Saturday.
Yeah, I mean, I think the game on Saturday just really shows you the kind of stuff he brings to the table. This is one of the more physically gifted, just raw athletes you're going to find in the league. In terms of just pure power and speed and athleticism, I don't know that you could name five guys in the league that have more of those attributes than he does. I think the big question mark with him, at least before all these health problems kept him out for so long, was, you know, he has all these physical gifts, but is he a truly elite finisher? Is he the kind of guy that can put up gaudy goal scoring numbers? And, you know, everyone knows the questions about his left foot and all that. Is he, you know, too reliant on the right foot? But, I mean, man, he looked really good on Saturday. He was running all over the place. He was even, you know, he was putting in work on defense. He had a really, I thought one of the better highlights of the game was this, more than the goals, was the switch pass he had at one point. That was just like, he gets so much, power, on those passes. And, what the Sounders are doing with him this year with Rui Diaz up top as the lone striker in the formation they like to play is they've pushed him out wide. And, you know, I think he said he's more comfortable as a striker and that's what he likes to play. But I think the wing is a good spot for him just because his biggest asset is really that speed, and it allows him to use that more and stretch the field and come at people from angles. And you've seen in preseason he's been working on his crossing. So I just think it was a really hugely psychologically important performance for him to see those balls go in the net after being out for so long. Because, you know, one of the big things he's talked about is just the physical rehab, but also the mental grind. You know, he just wanted to be back out there, and it was just therapeutic for him to have a performance like that. You could see it on his face after the game. He was just so happy, but also just seemed so relieved that he was back out there contributing and it went that well. And I've sort of been calling him an X factor as far as, you know, what him, you know, getting back to his old ways could mean to this team, because he's been out for so long. I think people have kind of forgotten about all these things that I was talking about as far as how gifted he is physically and, what he can bring to an attack. And especially if he's finishing like that. I mean, on his second goal, that cross comes in from Victor Rodriguez really fast, and he has to get to it in the box before the defender, but then also, shoot it by the goalkeeper, with his left foot, which his oft-criticized, maligned left foot. So, you know, if he suddenly becomes a guy that is scoring like that with both feet, I mean, that's just scary. And then you throw that in with Lodeiro, who's one of the better number 10s you're going to find in the league, Victor Rodriguez, who's had his own injury issues but is a very talented player, and then Rui Diaz, who's looking like an upper-tier striker in the league. This team is going to score a bunch of goals. I don't think there's much of a doubt about that if they stay healthy.
Absolutely. One of the things that maybe I'm curious about with the Seattle Sounders, I think certainly, you know, when they were down in the dumps right before they made another triumphant run to the playoffs last year, was wondering whether or not it was time to completely reset, shuffle out the old guard. And, you know, I don't want to use, you know, full hashtag trust the process, but maybe certainly hashtag play the kids. But, you know, obviously Rui Diaz comes in midseason and he's been a really good addition. I've really liked what I've seen from Kim Ki-hee, and maybe, you know, the last 6 months, a little bit of an adjustment to join MLS. But two gaping holes from the squad that made it to two MLS Cups are the now retired Clint Dempsey and Ozzie Alonso, who obviously is now with Minnesota United, also in the Western Conference. You know, those are two massive veterans. Those are two relatively big personalities in the locker room that are gone. The Sounders gone about replacing them, not only from the production they bring on the field, but also just from their leadership and their experience in this league?
Yeah, I mean, I think when it comes to Ozzy, that's the tougher cog to replace there. Dempsey was obviously a really great player on the team for a really long time. But I mean, the front four that we've been talking about, they can replace the goal scoring that he brought to the table relatively easily, I think. But with Ozzie Alonso, you're talking about literally, I mean, the best defensive midfielder that's ever played in the league. I don't know what name you could rightfully argue would be above him other than Diego Chara. And, you know, with Ozzie, what he brings to the table is so unique in terms of the amount of ground he can cover and how bruising and physical a defender he is, but then also how good a passer he is. I mean, he's completing 90% of his passes every year, and I mean, he's a two-way player, and skill sets like that are just extremely unique, and you can see that in over the years the Sounders have had a really hard time playing together and being cohesive when he's not on the field. That was a narrative around the team for a long time. Like, you know, this is one of the better teams in MLS when Ozzie Alonso is on the field. And if he's not on the field, which, you know, he's had some injury concerns, they really struggle. And so I think it's a fair question to ask about the team as to how they replace him and his leadership on and off the field and in the locker room, all that. I will say, I think the narrative of that being something that could potentially cap the team this year might be a little overblown, in the sense that they've had to play without him quite a bit, and especially last season, they finally found the cover that has worked for them. They have the pairing in the defensive midfield of Christian Roldan and Gustav Svensson, and that's exactly who they put out there last year whenever Ozzie was out for injury or was rotating out or whatever, and they held it down as well as they have, I think, in the MLS era when Ozzie Alonso hasn't been able to play. So those are two guys who can capably hold down the position. I think it remains to be seen if they can do that over the course of an entire season. I think a guy you're probably going to see rotate in there a lot more this year than he has had to in the past couple years is Jordy Delem. He is going to have to step up. And if there's a huge drop off at that part of the field when he's playing over or instead of Roldan or Gustav Svensson, then that could be a problem, and that could, you know, that could cost Seattle some results, frankly, because it's such an important part of the field. And, you know, if you don't have the cohesion there, it has a ripple effect on the rest of the team. So I think it's a fair question to ask about the team. But the way I see it, if they get, you know, a normal season's amount of games out of the Roldan and Svensson pairing, they should be able to mitigate it. I mean, there's a pretty large set of sample size at this point to suggest that they're able to function and play really well and win games when it's Roldan and Svensson back there and Ozzie's not on the field. And, you know, I think that's part of the reason that the Sounders felt comfortable letting him walk, even though he's such a beloved player for the franchise and was for so long and clearly still has it. If you look at how he played in the first game with Minnesota United, this is still a guy that can make a huge impact in the league. But I think, when you looked at his price tag and what it was going to take to keep him here, I think Garth Lagerwey probably looked at it and figured, look, we have two very good players in Gustav Svensson and Christian Roldan. Roldan, who's a key cog of the franchise. They just signed him to a big extension. So I think it's going to be tough to replace Ozzie, but I think they're as set up to do it as they could hope to be, given that they're losing someone of that stature and that talent level.
Of course. Let's move on to the matchup at hand. Colorado Rapids taking on Seattle Sounders. This will be at 8 p.m. on Saturday, Mountain Standard Time. Let's start with the Sounders defense taking on the Rapids attack. Ari, I feel like similar to sort of boxing in the attack into sort of younger in their prime players and the aging players that were phased out of the team last year, I can kind of do that a little bit with the defense as well. You know, you have Chad Marshall, Roman Torres, Kim Kihi, definitely, you know, veteran players at center back role, Stefan Fry, you know, an ageless wonder, you know, who is fantastic on Saturday. Safer, you know, I'm not sure Tim Howard in his prime is stopping that absolute laser that FC Cincinnati got to open their scoring in MLS. And then you've got a lot of young guys on the outside, Kevin Leerdam, you know, one of my favorite players to hype up in Nuhu Tolo, as you're aware. And then on the other side, you've got a whole bunch of new Rapids attackers, and all three Rapids players making their debut all scored on Saturday under extremely strenuous circumstances, is playing down a man and given the weather. What do you make of this particular matchup on the Rapids offense, Sounders defense side of the ball? And, you know, what are you seeing in particular in, say, Chad Marshall versus Kai Kamara in the air on Saturday?
Yeah, I mean, I think you just hit on the big one. I'll never bet against Kai Kamara scoring a goal in any venue. I mean, you know, I think he's like 33 or 34 now, and that's all the guy does. He's played for probably eight teams in the league at this point, and every new team that he goes to, he puts up numbers. That's when you pay him to join your team, there's a pretty safe baseline of what you're going to get, and he'll always be a handful. So, yeah, I mean, Chad Marshall versus Kai Kamara, that's that could be MLS circa 2012, and it would still be a good matchup. And I think even though they're both getting up there in age, that's the big one to watch. I think you'll see the Sounders try and key in on him and Kellen Acosta. You know, I think Seattle, they play a lot stronger defense when they're at home traditionally. So I think that's a big thing that plays into the matchup here. I think it's going to be tough for Colorado to count on scoring multiple goals. But I also think that if they can kind of turn it into a slog fest and use their own defensive prowess to sort of try and do whatever they can to squelch the Seattle attack, there's not necessarily there's a path to a result in the game. I mean, there always is. For the Rapids in this case, it's more just turning it into a grinded out battle than trying to get a shootout at CenturyLink with Seattle. I don't think there's that's not a very viable path to victory the way I see it.
Mm-hmm. Jack Price is definitely set up for a grinded out, getting stuck in game. Let's move on to the other side of things, Ari. The Rapids have a lot of injuries, particularly on the defensive side of the ball. Court Ford out pretty much long term. I heard from a source on Saturday after the match that they are hopeful about Tommy Smith being available for the Rapids, who does some good things in defense and is also very good in the air on both sides of the ball. But then you're looking at, especially with Axel Schuberg, who as of right now, his red card's still standing for a suspension. On Saturday, you're looking at a possible center back pairing of Danny Wilson and Declan Wynn. I'm not sure how much Rapids defense you watched last year, but that's not something to be confident about going into the clink. What do you see in the Sounders attack, and how do you, you know, do they see them targeting a particular person, or how do they go about breaking down the middle, where the Rapids, at least in the midfield, have gotten much stronger?
Yeah, well, I guess I associate the Rapids I guess in this case I was associating the Rapids defense with the 2016 Rapids, the legendary defensive stalwarts. So, but you know, I just think it's a tough ask, especially if you're talking about any reserves on the back line trying to deal with Jordan Morris coming at you, Ladero coming at you, Ruiz Diaz coming at you, Rodriguez coming at you. I mean, that is a handful, and they get rolling at home. You know, like they feed off the home crowd. When it kind of gets like a snowball rolling like that, it can be tough to stop. So I don't know how, Colorado is going to approach that tactically. But you know, like I said, I don't think you can back down from it. I think the answer is to kind of, you know, make sure that you're playing the game that you normally play and try and be physical where you can and get in their heads a little bit. And, if you can do that, I don't think, you know, I'll never rule anything out. I could see Colorado getting a 1-1 or, you know, if it's a really bad day and it all works out, and they poach a goal themselves, you know, maybe shock everybody and come in and win 1-0. I'm not saying I think that's what's going to happen, but, it definitely could with this league. You never know, right?
Mm-hmm, absolutely, Ari. I'm not surprised you don't have a great answer for the Rapids defense. We'll see whether or not Anthony Hudson can come up with an answer by this coming Saturday. Listeners, if you liked listening to Ari, follow him on Twitter at Ari Lilienwall, LILJENWALL, and obviously check out all of his Sounders musings at MLSsoccer.com, and also some of his audio work with Radio Cascadia. Ari, I'm going to close out with this interview. I'm not going to ask you to make a prediction, but can you at least give us a weather update and say that we're not going to get a Snow Classico 4 on Saturday?
I can say pretty confidently that there will be no Snow Classico in Seattle. I haven't looked at the weather, but we had our one snowstorm a year already. So I think it should be a nice day out there. It should be a great day for a game, and yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Fantastic. Ari, thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
Welcome back, listeners, to Holding the High Line with Rabbi in Red. My name is Matt Pollard. I want to thank Ari Lilienwald for his time that he spent with us to sit down to preview the Sounders' perspective on the Colorado Rapids game coming up this Saturday. Mark, we are currently 1/34th through the Rapids season. They have 1 point off of one draw and a goal differential of zero, obviously because they've only played one game and it was a draw. The Seattle Sounders have 3 points with a +3 goal differential off of their 4-1 win against MLS debutants FC Cincinnati. As I talked about with Ari, the Sounders are still a very, very good team, but a team somewhat in transition. Clint Dempsey and Ozzie Alonso, who were stalwarts and a major part of their success in Open Cup, in winning MLS Cup, are gone. The younger players of the Brad Smiths, the Christian Roldans, the Kevin Leardams, and certainly the Jordan Morrises have been elevated. And the Sounders also kind of have a similar situation a couple of years ago where their big selling point, or the thing that made them so good, was Dempsey to Obafemi Martins. Now they have that with a South American flair in the form of Nicolò Daro against Raul Ruy Diaz. They are a formidable opponent for the Rapids. They'll be taking on at CenturyLink Park at 8 p.m. on Saturday on Altitude Radio, Altitude Sports. And for those of you outside the state of Colorado, and presumably not in another market, available to you on ESPN+. Mark, what do you see in this matchup? What should the Rapids be focusing on?
Cool. This is going to be a tough one. I think that the biggest thing to worry about is, you know, the Rapids got a weather aided situation in Colorado that kind of leveled the playing field on many levels, and smoothed over some of the most challenging aspects. Also, they had a weird hiccupy game full of, as we mentioned, PKs, handballs, red cards, all sorts of weirdness. I watched this last game that Seattle started the season off, and granted, they played probably the worst team in Major League Soccer this year in FC Cincinnati, but they humiliated them. I mean, since he scored the opening goal, but it was a really lucky, amazing volleyed shot. But other than that, every minute of this game was controlled by the Sounders, and it was like relentless attack after relentless attack, and the most relentless attacker was Jordan Morris. I mean, Jordan Morris looked like a man who was possessed, and he was
possessed with, you know, good health.
Oh my God. I mean, take away his other ACL, it won't matter. The dude is still blazingly fast. There's a lot of talk preseason about the fact that Morris feels like he's best as a central striker, but that he's being moved out to the wing. He looked devastating as a winger. I mean, he just looked pacey and dangerous and able to cut in on both feet. He scored a goal with his left. He scored a goal with his right, you know, after having been criticized for a while that he was only right footed. You know, he's really the thing that will, I think he's a real problem for that back line. I mean, I really hope that Dylan Cerna and Keegan Rosenberry will watch tape this week and then figure out how to play him. But I mean, granted, you know, Alvis Powell was playing him on the right wing before, and Alvis Powell was trash. He was absolutely a garbage right back. I hope he never starts again for FC Cincinnati. He's just not good enough. But stopping Jordan Morris is going to be a problem. Getting through Christian Roldan is going to be a problem. Their two center backs, Kim Keehy and Chad Marshall, are fantastic. Stefan Fry, probably the best goalkeeper the last 2 years in a row for 2 years combined, even though he didn't win MLS Goalkeeper of the Year. So this is a very good team. They play very tight, and they really can devastate you if you give them too much space. And one of the challenges of the 4-4-2 diamond is that sometimes in wide spaces you can concede space. So we shall see whether this works out. Matt, what's the thing you're looking at from Seattle?
I mean, I've got two things. First of all, healthy bodies. You know, what are they going to look like? You know, as of recording, the Rapids haven't announced that they'll be challenging the suspension to Axel Schubert. I presume that, you know, that's probably not happening, and I'm not sure that he will even get overturned. So especially, you know, if Tommy Smith isn't able to go and start 90 minutes, you know, you're pretty much boxed boxed into having to start Declan Wynn and Danny Wilson, who did not have a good game when they played at Seattle Sounders this past year. So I think, you know, dealing with that from a defensive side, I think is going to be very difficult. I think the Rapids will probably be going in there and being, you know, they'll be content with a 0-0 or a 1-1 draw and look to be a little bit more defensive and absorb pressure, especially, you know, the four-headed monster that the Sounders are going to have, you know, in the attack. You know, Rodriguez had possibly the best game I've ever seen him with the Seattle Sounders. So any one of those guys is going to bury you. You know, we talked about it, you know, with the Timbers, you know, if you cut off service to Diego Valeri and if you cut off Diego Valeri from everybody else, you can kind of single out everybody else. I'm not sure you could just take out Nico Lodero and assume that you're going to be okay everywhere else. Rui Diaz could burn either of those center backs very easily. Jordan Morris cutting inside with his right foot could do a lot of really damaging things. You know, Rodriguez on an island in a 1v1 race with Keegan Rosenberry for a ball, I'm not sure I like that matchup either, especially on turf. So I think the Rapids are going to have to be very focused on the defensive side. I think it's going to be an excellent challenge and brain exercise for Benny Fellhaber or Jack Price or whoever's in that number six role. If you just look at it, folks, from the actual, the lineup formation graphics of what a 4-2-3-1, which is normally what the Sounders line up in, and I presume the Rapids will be in the 4-4-2 diamond, it naturally makes it such that you have individual matchups just with the shape of how the two formations are. Obviously, the two forwards for the Rapids are going to be focused on the two center backs, but then you kind of have a situation where maybe the number 10 and then one of the number 8s will be, you know, mainly matching up significantly with Christian Roldan and Gustav Svensson. So what does that look like, given that Nicholas Mesquita is probably very familiar with Christian Roldan, both of them having spent their entire MLS careers with Vancouver and Seattle, respectively, so they played each other a lot in Cascadia Cup. You know, whoever's in the number six role at the base of the diamond for the Rapids, their most of their responsibility is going to be the tracking of, the management of, and the negation of Nico Lodero. And, you know, even Jack Price in his best day, or Benny Fellhaber, who's been fantastic in the number six role, even going back to last year with LAFC, that's going to be a pretty tough task. You know, there are a lot of individual matchups in this game that I think if the Rapids were to just say, you know, let's just break even, you know, nobody gets an advantage, we don't shut them down defensively, they don't get anything offensively from it, and you'd probably take that. Rodriguez against Keegan Rosenberry, if that ends up being, you know, ends up going up in a wash, I'd probably take that. Jordan Morris against Dylan Serna, I'd probably take that. Nico Lodero against Jack Price, etc., etc. So, you know, there's a lot of, I don't see a whole lot of matchups, given how good the Sounders are, given the options that they have, and their style of play, and not only that, being at home playing on turf, I don't see a lot of matchups where it's super easy for the Rapids to gain an inherent advantage. I guess the one exception where I'd say that, you know, is maybe, you know, the duels, as I was talking about with Ari, you know, Chad Marshall against Kai Kamara, you know, these two guys have been going at it with each other for like the last 7 to 8 years, you know, and you know, Chad Marshall, you know, his two nicknames on the Sounders are Dad and Air Marshall. So, but, you know, like we were talking about with, defenders versus forwards, you know, all it's going to take is the Rapids to get a couple of corners. You know, say they get seven corners and then a couple long crosses from Keegan Rosenberry or Kellen Acosta serving in a ball into the box. You know, if there are 10 of those, Kai Kamara just has to win one of those matchups on Chad Marshall, and the Rapids have a really good chance of getting results. So that's maybe the one area where maybe he catches them, or maybe everybody occupying Kai Kamara opens up something else for somebody else who's going for a header in the box. But, you know, I think this is going to be a tough match for the Rapids. I think it's going to be a very good measuring stick in terms of where they are as a team, in terms of their organization against a perennial playoff team. And if they go in there and they get a 0-0 or a 1-1 draw, just as I was saying that, you know, the Rapids defeated the Portland Timbers 3-3, you know, a draw by any means, hook or by crook, on Saturday night at the Clink, I think is going to be perceived as a win. I think it's only going to help the Rapids' confidence grow and believing that they can do that, because they beat two really good teams. You know, they got two draws in extraneous circumstances with a bunch of injuries against two of the best teams in the Western Conference.
Agree.
Aha, Mark, now you are agreeing as opposed to me. Okay, let's go to Ask HTHL. We've got a bunch of...
When you're right, Matt, when you're right, you're right.
We've got a bunch of really, really good ones this week. We will start with Jody Robinson, who asks, hashtag HTHL, how does waving Gashi make sense? Wouldn't the Rapids have been better off letting him hang out for the season so the league would pick up one third of his salary or whatever? You know, getting into the single entity aspects of it. But was he gone? But with With him gone, any chance he goes, we get a second DP in the summer. Mark, we kind of already talked about how the Rapids would have had, okay, so let's say, Mark, that the Rapids with relatively, the Rapids are easily and without significant financial hardship are able to acquire another international roster spot on Friday afternoon such that they're allowed to keep Gashi. What does Gashi's 2019 season look like? And what do the finances look like where the Rapids could do anything before January 1, 2020 when Gashi's salary comes off the books?
So for me, the critical question here is almost philosophical in nature, which is it's about something called the sunk cost fallacy or the sunk cost. The sunk cost fallacy is the belief that you have spent X amount of dollars on a thing and therefore you need to recoup those dollars no matter how bad an idea that is, right? Like, so the idea here is, well, Gashi was expensive and he's not playing very well, but he's expensive, so we have to play him, right? If a player is bad, but he was expensive, playing him does not change the fact that he's bad, right? If you have a $65,000 player and a $2 million player, you don't play the $65,000 player is better. You don't play the $2 million player because, well, we got to get our money's worth, right? And more so to that point, if you have a $1.67 million player and he's not very good and he's not one of your better strikers and you're not going to play him, then on top of that, you don't want to go out and pay what is realistically going to cost $150,000 to buy somebody else's international slot in order so that he could stay on the team. And that's what the Rapids were going to have to do. They were going to have to not only pay Gashi $1.67 million to mostly sit on the bench in 2019, they were going to have to pay another $150,000 on top of that just to keep compliant with the league rules about how many international slots they have. And I think, and I don't know this, but I will ask the team if I get the chance, that the idea was, let's just cut our losses. We can't pay this guy. We don't want to pay this guy to sit on the bench. We're probably going to have to pay him either way. And we certainly don't want to have to pay more, even if it's the significantly underwhelming sum of $150,000 for an international slot. We just don't want to pay him for that. Now, it's arguable. You could say, what if? Here's the big what if of this whole situation. What if this was the Renaissance year for Gashi? What if with the $1.67 million you pay him, he actually does have a really good season? What if you have two starting strikers go down and Gashi steps in and just starts banging in free kicks from all over the field? Then you kind of say, like, well, you kind of screwed it up. I think the Rapids looked at his level of fitness, his level of performance the last two seasons, and what they could reasonably expect out of the strikers they already had and say, it's better to cut bait than fish.
No, I agree with you, Mark. I think it's a couple of really, really good points on that front. I think the one thing to answer your second question, Jody, about the Rapids getting a second DP, because the Rapids waived him, Gashi's money and his salary are still on the books. So someone would have to pick up Gashi either off of waivers, or he would have to get loaned out, or there'd have to be a transfer such that enough of his salary came off the book such that the Rapids were able to recoup an open DP slot. They still have the third, but the Rapids haven't used that third DP slot, you know, since 2016 when Tim Howard, or 2 years ago when Kevin Doyle retired from the team. So I don't see them getting a third, I don't see them getting a new second DP now since they've always had that open third DP slot and then just never used it. And something else is going to have to happen with Gashi's future and where he's playing and who's paying him for the Rapids to open up the second DP slot to just have Howard on the books in order to do something. I don't think they're going to do anything in the summer. It's going to have to be a really, really good opportunity for them to open up the third one. I think as Mark, you and I, we both talked with a number of people in the front office. I think everything's going into that winter transfer window of 2020 when the anticipation is that they'll bring in a forward and then a central attacking midfielder. And then it's all guns blazing going into 2020. But, you know, I didn't think that was happening this season anyways. something really big is going to have to happen with Gashi for his money to come off the books for the Rapids to do that. And I don't think they're doing anything else with another DP slot as long as they're still having to pay Tim Howard the 2.4 in change. Let's move on to another question that we have, Mark. I will take this one. This one comes from Matt Anderson. Matt asks, doubt this stat exists, but would love to know the percentage chance of the Rapids getting a result when a team concedes a PK, an own goal, and goes down a man in the first half. Obviously quite low. Matt, it's kind of hard to track this just given the, just the general, how rare all three of those occurrences happen in general, and then let alone to try and find an instance of that happening in MLS recently in which all three of those occur, and then for that to be significant enough, have that happen enough times to have a big enough sample size in order to draw a conclusion. So in lieu of that, Matt, I'm going to track. I went down and I did a whole bunch of math before Mark and I hit the record button, just looking at red cards in 2018 in the MLS regular season, and how did those teams that had a player sent off do? And I track this general red cards and then also red cards that occurred in the first half. So in the entirety of MLS, there were 87 red cards last year for the entire regular season. Mark, do you want to guess how many of those 87 games the red carded team lost?
Lost. I'm going to go 50.
50? Okay, you're a little bit low. It ended up being 56. So teams that had a player sent off had a record in 2018 in MLS of 18 wins, 54 losses, and 13 draws. That ends up being a win percentage chance of 21%, a loss percentage chance of 64%, and a draw percentage chance of 15%. Now, when that red card occurred in the first half, and I would say this is independent of scoreline, Matt, and this is also independent of whether or not that red card led to a PK that then allowed the team that was up a man to score a goal as well. The loss percentage chance was 75%, the draw percentage chance was 19%, and the win percentage chance was a lowly 14%. So by simply, you know, let's say that, you know, the weather and the conditions, you know, obviously, this was general in terms of when the red card occurred. This was not taking into account who was home and who was away, what was the score line. And obviously, as we've said a number of times on this episode, any of this in the context of having 4 inches of snow on the ground and freezing temperatures is a wash to a certain extent. But the general consensus based on the data here is that a red card is a death sentence in MLS, especially in the first half. If you're getting anything from the game, you're super lucky, and especially given that following the PK from Diego Valeri, that the Rapids, you know, had an extra hour to play down a man. You know, I think the expectation was the Rapids probably should have lost that game 3-1 with the Timbers, you know, jogging out the final 10 to 15 minutes of regular time. So just for them to get to draw, let alone to do it in the environmental conditions and after conceding two goals, I think, you know, very, very unlikely, very lucky, and then also a testament to just how they were able to fight back and try and get something from the game. Let's move on.
By the way, to Matt for doing that, Matt went out and manually counted all 87 games. I'm not making this up. He manually counted all 87 red card games last year in the league to figure out how often a team won. So big props to you, Matt.
Thanks, Mark. And I will say, the Rapids did not win any games in which they got a red card last year, and no former Rapid who got a red card ended up having their team ultimately win the game. Shane O'Neill got a red card for Orlando City FC. Orlando ended up losing that game. And let's see if there was anybody else who I was missing from that. I don't think that there were any other Rapids players who got carded, any former Rapids players who got carded. But yeah, it's generally a bad thing when a red card goes against you, and it's a virtual death sentence, especially in the first half. Let's move on to our final Ask HTHL of the night. This one comes from Austin Muniz. I'll throw this to you, Mark. What did you guys think of Cole Bassett's performance while he was there? Thought he looked pretty good in the short time he had. I believe Cole Bassett was subbed off for Jack Price in the 40th minute. Mark, your thoughts on Cole Bassett or with the TV resolution and the snow, were you even able to tell which one he was?
Oh yeah, and also I'm watching the games and I'm looking at the stats. If we're talking about making a joke about our other favorite podcast, Extra Time, which is drop the radio so that they could go do video. I don't think Matt and I are ever planning on doing video. We just don't have as spectacular backdrops for our apartments and or houses. Bassett only played 39 minutes before he was subbed off for Jack Price, which I think was mostly a defensive move. Price just has a little bit more steel in the defense. And if you look at his numbers, you'll see that Cole Bassett's tackle numbers in this game weren't very good. It seems like he really positioned himself upfield, ready to receive a pass. And either he or Anthony Hudson said, don't worry about the defense. Bassett had 69.2% passing on only 13 passes, which means he basically biffed on 4 of his 13 passes, 9 completed. He had one really beautiful take on where he just absolutely shredded his defender. He had no shots in the game, but he generally looked to be problematic and troubling to the opposition. He's going to need I watched him carefully. There were a couple situations where he got into a space where he drew two defenders to him and opened up a pocket for somebody else. That's a thing that you're going to have to watch is like, is Cole Bassett being effective or is he, does he look like he's being ineffective because he's occupying other defenders? That's a thing that we could talk about with Diego Rubio too, who, didn't have big numbers on this game, but he often got into nuisance type positions. We'll see how that goes, when he gets more than 29 minutes in another game. So, I thought Cole Bassett was fine. I don't think he's being asked to do a ton this year. I don't think he's asked to make the most important run, the get into the box and score, or the line breaking, deep lying pass. I think he's supposed to occupy the defense, make 1-2 touch passes, make runs that drag people out of position. If he has to compare him to Portland, Portland has a right-sided midfielder by the name of Andy Polo. And Polo's a very talented player who has spent the better part of the last year in Major League Soccer making runs through the back line that require a defender to get dragged with them only so that he can do absolutely nothing when he does it. Polo doesn't have a lot of goals or assists from last season, but he was an important part of the Portland Timbers. Honestly, if that's Bassett's role this year, get a couple goals, get a couple assists, make a couple of MLS assists or, you know, the pass to the pass to the pass that leads to the goal, and to drag the defenders away, then he's done his job. But I think we're going to need to see Cole Bassett especially evolve as a defender. The last thing I'll lead us with is this. When Cole Bassett was on the field for 39 minutes, he had 0 tackles, 0 interceptions, 2 clearances, both which were in the box on free kicks, 0 block shots, and 0 fouls. By comparison, the guy who filled in for him, who only played, 50-something minutes, was Jack Price. And Price had an interception, a clearance, and a block shot in his time, plus a whole bunch of what are called recoveries. I think Price had 7 recoveries and Bassett had none. So for Bassett and for me, the question is, will he evolve defensively? And I think it's there. And I think it's about whether the team makes that an important role for him. But it's something that I think is important and we need to see by the end of the season.
Well said, Mark. I think this is officially the longest episode in history. Granted, we had a lot to talk. And we had a million things to talk about, and we had a guest, and we had two player interviews that I had to crop and edit. So why don't we get out of here? Listeners, you can follow us individually on Twitter @soccer_rabbi, @LWSMattPollard. Check out our Rapids Musings @TheDenverPost and @LastWordOnSports.com. Head on over to DenverPost/HTHL, all lowercase, for especially on all of the Denver Post digital content that'll then open up a whole bunch of other stuff, including Mark's work with Backpass with the Denver Post. Follow our podcast on Twitter at Rapids96 Podcast and send us your questions using the hashtag AskHTHL. If you have an AskHTHL that's longer than 280 characters, or you want to get in touch in more long form, email us at Rapids96Podcast@gmail.com. Thank you to CR54 Designs for our podcast art. Thank you to Wanners for our music, including our new inter-segment intro or inter-segment segue that we used for the first time. And thank you, of course, to Ari Lilienwald for joining me separately for our first segment of Know That I Anime. With that, thank you very much for joining us, listeners. We'll see you next week for hopefully a briefer but equally happy episode of Holy Highlander.
Peace!